I'm Jim Falk, President of World Affairs Council. Of course, the most important logistics is this. Before you leave, better have some cookies, because I can't take all of those home, and neither can our staff. But quite seriously, thank you all for being here on such short notice. And it is certainly timely and a great honor for the World Affairs Council to welcome His Excellency Ambassador Jerónimo Guterres. I want to also thank, as always, our good friends at Hunt Consolidated, who are, I've been at the council now for a little bit over 15 years, and I have to tell you that Hunt has been a company that has always been represented on our board and has always answered special requests from the World Affairs Council and even sometimes call us and say, what can we do to help you? And that is certainly appreciated. They're represented today by two of their executives, and if I could ask them both to stand and be recognized, Enrique Marroquin, who's the president of Hunt Mexico, and Roberto Aguirre, vice president of commercial development. Thank you, gentlemen. Now, Your Excellency, there are many representatives of the DFW Consular Corps in the room today, and I want to especially thank the Consul General of Canada, who serves as the Dean of the Consular Corps, for being here. And of course, this would not happen, Sarah Wilshaw, and of course, this would not happen if we didn't have our good friend have to think about what his full name is, because we're such good friends. He calls me Jaime, and I call him Paco, but Francisco de la Torre. Thank you, Francisco. We also have with us today Senator Don Huffines. Thank you, sir, for being here. I think it's your first time to the World Affairs Council offices, although you've met with lots of visitors.
Yeah, that's true, it is.
Good.
It's come a lot in the 90s.
Oh, that was even before me. And then we have members of our board, and if I could ask James Waters, our vice chairman, and other members of our board of directors to stand. David Jacobs, Anika, stand. Let's. You all sign our paychecks. I want you to stand. You know, I'm not going to take a lot of time reading a long bio. That's the reason that we put it in there for you. But I just want to say that we are glad you're here. We're glad that you have such a rich Texas experience, because we know that you came here from San Antonio, where you were managing director of the North American Development Bank, and most importantly, was and still is a member of the board of directors at the World Affairs Councils. Many of you know our good friend Tony Garza, who will be coming to speak at the World Affairs Council in just a few weeks. When he was asked about your nomination, he said that you are Guterres is respected for his insights and integrity on all sides of the aisle, and in both countries makes him both extraordinary and an inspired selection. What we're going to do today is we're going to have remarks from the ambassador for as long as he wants, but I bet it'll be about 10 minutes. I might ask some questions, and then we're going to open it up for a candid discussion. This is off the record, not for attribution, but or maybe it is for attribution, but off the record. Your call, sir.
I'm fine with that. I'm
okay.
To be consistent.
So. Good. All righty. The podium is yours.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Kylie. Good afternoon. First of all, let me thank Jaime for that very nice introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. I really thank you for your time and interest in being here this afternoon. I feel very much at home in Texas. Indeed, I have been, until I was nominated just in February, I had been living 6.5 years in the Lone Star State. I mentioned earlier today that half jokingly, when I was saying goodbye or at least farewell to San Antonio, I told them that the good thing is now that Texas will have an ambassador in Washington at 911 Pennsylvania Avenue. So I do like the Lone Star State. My children are, in fact, leaving. They decided not to go to D.C., although they like it. They're still here, so that still keeps me close to Texas. Let me say that it's wonderful to see Sarah Wilshaw, the Consul General of Canada, good friends from a long time, and it's good to have you, Senator, and Francisco, our Consul General, and all of the board members of the Council. It's a pleasure. I don't know exactly where to start, but let me do my best. When I was, during my confirmation hearing, this was back in January of this year, which wasn't a ride on the park. I got asked about where's the state and the foreseeable future of U.S.-Mexico relationship. And I did mention that I thought that U.S.-Mexico relations were at a critical point. And so, sure enough, the next day, you know, several newspapers, you know, front page, the U.S.-Mexico relationship is in crisis, new ambassador. I got a call from my boss, and the president says, you're starting well, as the, you know? And, you know, and actually I said, you know what, I'm going to keep saying the same thing. But let's differentiate being in a crisis versus being in a critical point. I think it's important. It's not only semantics. It's if we understand a critical point as a point in time in which, unless appropriate actions is taken, the status quo would be significantly different, I think we are definitely at a critical point. That I'm convinced. I do believe that it is within our grasp for Mexico and the United States to have a much more mature relationship. And it's also possible, nevertheless, to have a serious setback. And I'll try to explain why. And I think there, you know, over the last 25 years, essentially, the trend line between, in the relationship between Mexico and the United States has been, in general, a very positive one. That doesn't mean, obviously, that we have not had differences and that we have not had challenges. And we will continue to have, I think, challenges and differences. But I think that over this period of time, essentially since NAFTA was enacted almost a quarter of a century ago, we've learned two or three important things. The first one is that our economic interaction, our economic interdependence, it's important, obviously, for both sides. And it's actually it actually implies a win-win situation. That doesn't mean that trade is easy for every firm, every sector, at all time. That's not what trade is about. It just simply means that we have, as a result of our taking that huge step forward, along with our Canadian friends, obviously, we are on balance better than if we would have not, I think, proceeded with the North American Free Trade Agreement. The second thing that we've learned, I think it's important, I would just try to summarize it, is that we're better off if we are communicating with each other and if we're trying to cooperate and cooperating that rather pointing fingers at each other. And the U.S.-Mexico relationship, you know, for many actually decades, we were described, and rightly so perhaps, I think, as distant neighbors by Alan Riding, the popular New York Times correspondent in Mexico. He described rightly that Mexico and the United States were distant neighbors. And suddenly, what we began to do is move from that notion of distant neighbors to something different. Partners, neighbors, strategic partners. And that, I think, has implied that over the last 25 years, the trend line, and as someone said, not the headlines of the relationship, have been good. I'm a firm believer of that. And nevertheless, and it's no secret that as the new administration took office, we found ourselves, the new administration here in the United States took office, we have found ourselves, again, with some important differences. I would say that this is our first major disagreement on the post-NAFTA era. And that is important. I would be remiss if I wouldn't, you know, if I tried to sugarcoat the fact that perhaps it's our most critical and most difficult time in at least 25 years. Some people talk, say 50, some people go even farther. And every time they go farther, I get more scared because now I'm the ambassador. But I think that, yes, we have differences. They're public, they're known. And so let me tell you why I think we are going to overcome them and we're going to be successful. And the first thing is that Mexico wants, and I think the mass majority of Mexicans, the Mexican government certainly, and Mexicans want a relationship based on very simple principles. Respect, a relationship that works and a relationship that is mutually beneficial. The second thing is that as some of the positions of President Trump became public, when he was a candidate, have somewhat evolved. As a result of, I think of largely two factors. The first one is that people from the private sector in the United States have been speaking to the administration about what actually the relationship is and what it's not about. The good, the bad, and the ugly. And I think that that has helped educate some of the members of the administration here. I'm not saying, and I want to be perfectly clear, that the challenges or the objectives, some of the objectives that have been presented by President Trump and his administration are not legitimate. I'll give you an example. There's a concern, obviously, here about manufacturing employment. And that's a very legitimate concern that most countries, if not all countries, presently have. The question is, what can we do to improve that situation in a way that doesn't hurt any one of the parties? A lot of people, the private sector, and people that have that really know about what the relationship is about, what are the true challenges, what are the difficulties, have had, in my view, to go out of their way this time and go a little bit more public on that. Because a lot it's at stake in the bilateral relationship. As it's often said, we trade $1.5 billion a day. A lot of employment in Mexico and the United States precisely depends on that trade. And there is at least significant data that would show that in the sectors with manufacturing employment has been either declining or not growing enough are precisely sectors that are not linked to our trade relationship. Or that, in fact, the deficit, the trade deficit that the United States has is bigger with those countries, whether in absolute terms or as a percentage of the total trade, with those countries that, in fact, do not have a trade agreement with the United States. So to make a point short, the administration, the Trump administration, has presented the position of let's review, improve, modernize NAFTA. By all means, let's do it. And our Canadian friends are now on board with that. It's, I think, and I can speak also for my Canadian friends, we want to keep free trade, and we want to keep trade fair, which is something that has been voiced. That is, and we believe that we can modernize NAFTA in a way that can benefit the three countries and that can certainly address concerns here in the United States without harming any one of the parties. And that's pretty much where we're at. Formal negotiations will probably begin sometime during the summer, and I think that it's not going to be easy. Any trade negotiation is difficult, but I think we have a fair chance of achieving a good deal. And a deal needs to be, sorry the redundance, but a deal needs to be a deal in order to work, right? And that's what we're attempting. Now, on the other hand, I want to be as short so we can have as much dialogue as possible. We do have other challenges. There is a legitimate concern in the United States about security and about what immigration implies in the United States. That's, again, those are valid concerns. Two quick things. And I think we haven't done enough in talking about, in fact, what Mexico and the United States do together to address security concerns. Because on a daily basis, our intelligence agencies, the DEA, the FBI, DHS, all the security agencies are on a constantly working with its Mexican counterparts in addressing concerns that are shared. Drug trafficking, money laundering, human trafficking. That does not mean in any way that Mexico does not have very significant challenges still ahead, but we want to continue cooperating with the United States to address those challenges. And finally, I've been in some way or another linked to the discussion about immigration in the United States for the past 20 years. And it's a very it's a very thorny issue. It's difficult. It's even in Mexico. Just some things that my own view is, A, neither Mexico or the United States, I think, can feel satisfied in which the way we're handling this right now. The Mexican government, to make sure, does not promote or condone undocumented immigration. We don't want that. And we would not advocate for anybody to enter undocumented or break the law of any other one country. The fact is that there is a demand and there is a supply for labor. There's huge mobility. We have complementary population dynamics between our countries. And we are obviously geographically thin. That, without a appropriate scheme to manage the migration phenomenon, it does create a problem. The Mexican government wants to be part of the solution, not of the problem. This is something that will obviously have to be decided by the United States through its own democratic process. But we hope that at some point in time, we can work together in whatever is appropriate to have a better way to address this, what immigration means. I think we had a very difficult January, to be honest. February improved somewhat. March didn't close all that bad. I think that we will be able, as long as we continue communicating, we're respectful to one another, we're clear about where we stand, and as the administration here has settled, I think we have a much more stable bilateral discussions and agenda, and that I think we will be able to solve many of the differences we have right now. I thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I look forward to your comments and questions. Thank you.
Jaime. It happens just this morning. I was having coffee with an SMU student who was eager to remain in the United States to continue to work before he returned back to Mexico, and that was the purpose of our visit. And he was telling me about the sense he feels that young people in Mexico are really changing their attitude for the United States. And regrettably, I know that the political rhetoric here has created tension between some Americans and people of Mexican heritage or some of the people who are living here. And I asked this young man, I said, how would you describe the frustration in Mexico? And he used three words: distrust, anger, and disappointment. And so I want to ask you, how do you think the relationship, let's assume, and I want to put the wall aside, but let's assume that NAFTA is renegotiated, how can the relationship be rebuilt?
Well, I think that the disappointment comes from the fact that, the governments in Mexico, the past, since the early 1990s, the governments of Mexico, irrespective of party, have basically had a very similar view about the economic model that we should follow. And that model and the narrative behind that is, it's about free trade. It's about working with the United States. It's about having a good relationship with the United States. And all of a sudden, we got somewhat surprising positions during the campaign here last year and to some extent from the present administration. I have seen, I think, over the past 25 years, the anti-American sentiment in Mexico diminish clearly. And if you look at some polls on Mexico about what Mexican thinks of Americans in the United States, they're actually very positive as compared to another country. There is a risk that will, of having a setback on that. Mm-hmm. I think that the way, to rebuild the relationship is, I do believe that we will find a good solution about how to improve NAFTA. I'll get right into the wall. And the wall is just, it's not an issue on the bilateral relationship. Mm-hmm. We don't question the right of any country, obviously including the United States, to protect its borders, to control its borders, to secure its people. That's obvious. It's just not part of the relationship, of the bilateral relationship. The possibility of having Mexico pay for that is just simply not there. And as several voices, including some from Texas, have expressed, it's not even clear that's the right, you know, the best way to go in order to achieve the objectives that the administration is pursuing. Over the course of the past 6 weeks, there have been many cabinet members meeting between Mexico and the United States. And I could just tell you that we have agreed not to touch on that subject in a way that we can move forward with other things. I think the first meetings have been good first meetings. Mm-hmm. And I hope that in the end, the weight of the so many things that happened in the relation will allow us to continue in a very positive trend line. I'm still, you know, I'm modestly optimistic that that will be the case. You cannot expect also at the same time that, you know, that given the breadth of the bilateral relationship, there's not going to be disagreements ever. That just won't happen. I think
it's a
that's
marriage.
That's part of what we, the reality. I just think that also people in Mexico are a little bit more nuanced in the sense that they are able to discriminate that a position on the part of the president might not reflect the view of everybody, certainly not all political actors in the United States, maybe not or certainly not all of Americans. The same happens in Mexico. Mm-hmm. They would like to see other things, you know, coming out of the administration, certainly, and I think we'll reach them.
Let me ask you about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because I frankly feel that if President Trump hadn't made his decision so quickly, they might have found a way to stay in the way the administration is sort of moving back from some of the rhetoric on NAFTA and elsewhere. But how has Mexico redirected its efforts in light of the United States' withdrawal from the trade agreement?
Well, we've basically done two things. Or three, actually. The first one is that we're still working with what we call a Pacific Alliance, mm-hmm. which is the Latin American countries, first of all, Colombia, Chile, Peru, and we're moving forward with basically what was agreed at TPP. There was recently a meeting in Santiago de Chile of the Pacific Alliance countries with all former TPP countries. The United States was invited. And we are basically going to pursue that same agenda. The second thing is we're moving forward with also updating our agreement with the European Union. Mm-hmm. And that's also moving forward. And the third one, in the view of some people, the way to update NAFTA is actually to incorporate some of the things that had been agreed in TPP as part of the bilateral and trilateral discussions that we will have between Canada, Mexico, and the United States in a way that can be moved forward. There's still a lot of uncertainties, to mm-hmm. be honest. There's not a clear path. The administration here must first notify Congress of its intent to formally negotiate. Then it's a 90-day period comment. Our understanding is they're waiting for the U.S. Trade Representative to be confirmed by the Senate, at which time 90-day process, they will notify Congress, and then we will have to start formal negotiations.
You know, being Mexico's ambassador to the United States is not necessarily job security, because there have been a number of ambassadors, I believe five in the last 5 years.
Something of that,
and
sir.
So I wanted to ask you, Is it a change in policy, or is it a desire of your government to have perhaps an ambassador who may be closer to the administration? I don't know. Do you have a relationship with people in administration? And second question, and this will be my last one, and we'll open it up. With so many constituencies that you are responsible for, how do you prioritize your efforts?
Well, let me start with that first question. It's something, you know, one of the major challenges for me as an ambassador, and that it's, I don't know to what extent happens in other, you know, other diplomatic representations, is discriminating what's information. Mm-hmm. You're exposed to so much information about what goes on from, you know, we have 50 consulates in the United States, from other embassies, from our interaction with the federal government of the United States, from interaction with state governments. And discriminating what's urgent, what's relevant, and what's just, you know, day-to-day business, it's very, I mean, I think you can get lost if you're not careful in that. Mm-hmm. That has been a very important challenge for me. The changes, it's true, and, you know, the Peña administration was somewhat, you know, criticized because there have been at least, you know, four ambassadors in this administration, myself being the fourth one. First of all, the very last change just was perhaps something natural because Carlos Sada, who's my predecessor, has now gone to the foreign ministry, and he's serving as assistant secretary for North American Affairs. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know, mind you, I'm not of the same party of the president, Peña Nieto, which attests, but I think that I've learned over the years to understand also what the United States is about and what it's not. And I think that in previous, I've worked in national security for a while, I've cooperated with security agencies here in the United States, and I happened to be involved in, you know, at another difficult time in 2003 when the Iraq War was taking place, mm-hmm. and we were sitting at the UN Security Council. And it's not easy for me to talk about myself, but one of the things is I have always also tried to educate Mexico about what the United States is about. I think there are plenty of things for which the United States should and is, in fact, admired worldwide. I'm surprised that it is the Americans that are the less optimistic about where the United States leadership. Mm-hmm. This idea that the United States leadership is somehow residing, I think it's nonsense. I think, you know, the United States continues to be called upon to exercise a very positive leadership worldwide. Still no other country contests the United States militarily, economically, or politically. And it's not easy also for the United States. Mm-hmm. And I can understand that. There's a lot of debate going on right now about what's the role the United States should play. We're no longer in the Cold War, although maybe that will change soon.
May change overnight.
Overnight. You know, but whether it's, you know, the... I think we're still living, in some way, the, you know, the latest part of the, you know, of the Cold War, a mixture of what Francis Fukuyama called, you know, the end of history, with the terrible effects of 9/11, which just have had a huge impact worldwide. So it's a messy world, and I feel sometimes when I talk to my American friends. And I know that there's a profound debate about what leadership the United States should play. And I can understand that that has happened before, in my view. But never when you have so much communication and so much interdependence in worldwide. So the way that the United States is debating its world role right now has happened before. Mm-hmm. Maybe at the beginning of the 20th century, but not in a way that everybody's seeing what's happening. You know, it's a debate that affects worldwide.
Well, as you know, that's the way the World Affairs Council started in 1918,
exactly.
Because the United States was debating.
And I think what has been helpful is I have attempted always to be an honest counterpart with the United States. That's why I was probably considered to be, and that has allowed me to work well with the United States, and that's perhaps the reason that I'm now there.
Well, with your permission, may we open it
up? Sure.
Roland, did you have a question? And then we'll be sure to get you, Senator, next.
Since somebody came up with a radical idea that we build a wall on your territory, why don't you say yes, we pay for it, but you want it on your southern border. And do us both a favor. It's a shorter border, cost us less, and I think your problem is with Middle America.
Thank you for the comment, and we'll take questions now.
I do have to say that the Secretary of the Interior statement was somewhat misunderstood when he made that statement. To my knowledge, he was talking to ranchers in Texas about the wall, and his statement actually created a huge uproar in Mexico. I was reading the news and saying, somebody's proposing, that now they don't need, not only do they want us to pay for it, they want us to do it on our side. It was like, and if you look carefully at the statement, it's not really about that. On our southern border, let me, now that you touch it, it's important.
I guess it is a question.
Not because the United States asked, not because we're doing, the bad cop job for the United States, but we do a lot of things in our southern border. I'll give you a number. Every year, Mexico repatriates, deports 190,000 Central Americans on our southern border, 190,000. The challenge for both the United States, Mexico has become much more of a transit country rather than origin country. And what we attempt to do, because it's not easy, and that's why many people understand the challenges that the United States faces. First of all, we have to try to keep the high moral ground and do what we're doing in our southern border and what we demand from the United States in terms of respecting the rights of people, the basic, civil and human rights, do the same, number one. Number two, we're having to cope with the same type of challenges in many ways that communities in the United States face with increased immigration. I'll just close with, just yesterday we were with Secretary Kelly from the Homeland Security Department. There's going to be and he had a good idea, and the United States and Mexico, along with Canada, are convening a meeting in June in Florida, in which the Central American, not all Central American, the Northern Triangle countries will be there along with Mexico, the United States, Canada, to try to address those things. Yes, borders and security, and also development in Central America. Because you cannot rely only on the enforcement part to solve this equation.
Well, Senator, welcome to Dallas, Ambassador.
Thank you very much, Senator.
It's always great to see you. Similar question, but what is Mexico doing or plan to do about illegal immigration on the northern border?
Well, let me first start with a very basic thing that it's not often said, and that I think it's not the right thing. The vast majority of Mexicans that have come to the United States over the last 30 years, undocumented, came here because they had no opportunity in their country. And that's not the responsibility of the United States, nor the fault of the United States. So the first thing Mexico must recognize, and it's not often done, is recognize that we are the ones responsible for generating those opportunities. I think that will be an important change in the narrative. Because the worst thing that can happen is have Mexico be perceived, and especially its government, as cynical. We just, take care of our problem. Here you go with 500,000 people. Huh? And that's sometimes the message that we send, I know. The problem starts there. We need to make sure, and that's the primary responsibility of Mexico, that whoever decides to come here first is not forced into that decision because he or she could not, provide the very basics for their family. That's number one. The second thing is recognize that the laws of the United States should be respected. And make sure that no one is advocating, which we don't, the Mexican government, for someone to enter undocumented the United States. It's very important also. The third thing is that we do have to recognize, Senator, that there's also a demand here for at least in several sectors, if not on all of them. And we don't have enough legal avenues for people to come here, maybe spend a year or a season working and return, whether it's in the hospitality sector, in the agricultural sector, or others. I'm not an expert. Mexicans don't have a chip implanted in themselves saying, hey, I want to cross the border and break U.S. law. That's not the case. They came here out of necessity, and that we shouldn't blame on the United States. That's our fault. If we have those avenues, and that's the discussion that we would propose, let's see what those avenues are. Let me give you an example. The H-1A visas, which is agriculture visas, have no cap. And yet there are undocumented Mexicans that work in the agricultural sector. Probably, I would say, several hundred thousands. Why? Why if there's no cap? Are those people coming undocumented? To me, it's a relevant question. Is it because it's a cumbersome process? Is it because information? Is it because the employers do not want to actually equate, because if they're legal, they probably have to pay higher wages? I don't know the answer. But if we look at that objectively, and Mexico does its part, first of all, generating opportunity, second, promoting legal avenues, not promoting that people come undocumented, we might have a much better solution. And in the end, and not very far away, it's all about population dynamics also. And I was just recently with Mr. Kaplan here at the Reserve, and he said, you know what, people think that there's, he uses a term that I have never heard, slack in the U.S. economy, meaning that there's actually a lot of oversupply of labor in sectors. And he said, that's not the case. We're going to need that workforce to grow in the future. And he's a pretty competent guy. I think that, you know, in the year 2000, Mexico attempted to work with the United States to try to reach some sort of agreement. And also Mexico needs to be willing, in my view, to receive, you know, what are you putting on the table in terms of migration? Are you really willing to, you know, tell your people don't cross undocumented? Are you really working to be serious so people don't be forced? I don't know. There are several things that we, but if we do that, I think we might find a better solution. And then finally, there's another part of the equation. It's what do you do with the people that are already here? Yeah. Which is, you know, an important number. That's up for the United States to decide. And it's very difficult for us as a government to opine in something that it is very much for the United States to process through its own democratic process. If you ask my view, then I'll not be diplomatic. I'll go into the... It's unlikely that all those people can actually be deported, even if you try. My own view is that a middle-of-the-ground solution will make it. And I know that there's concern about not rewarding people that have broken the law. I think that's right. But you cannot deny a reality that it's there. And if you don't look at also that issue, you're probably not going to find a solution that lasts. I think it's I can, you know, share concerns of there are communities here in the United States, some of them in Texas, which is actually the border, that the number of Hispanics, not necessarily Mexican, but Hispanics, and when you say Hispanics, you're basically talking about 80% of Mexicans around there, have, you know, suddenly communities that have grown for having non-Hispanics to suddenly having, you know, population growing Hispanic, thousands, you know, 1,000% a year. And in some cases, at least, and certainly that type of social change brings a lot of challenges and tensions. But it's probably not much unlike what you had with the Irish, the Polish, the German, and the British throughout history. Maybe the numbers change, but it's not a huge difference. Mm-hmm. I do believe that this country, part of its strength is the fact that it has always been a welcoming country. And if that continues, I think the United States would be serving itself.
Wes, I believe you have a question.
Sure. Thank you, Ambassador. I think you'll find in this room and in this state a more, hopefully one of the more nuanced views of these immigration issues than in some of the other parts of the country. Our own President George Bush signed the Human Trafficking Victims Act to protect particularly these young women and mothers and kids from Central America and other parts of the world who often too transit across Mexico. But we have welcomed them with open arms in this country and particularly in this state. And there are armies of lawyers who are working to make sure that the rights that they were granted in part through the efforts of President George Bush are being honored. And that's part of the tradition in this country that I think you'll see being exemplified here in Texas. And we appreciate your help in that regard.
Thank you, sir. We'll certainly there.
Larry.
Thank you, Ambassador, for coming. I noticed looking at your CV that you've also worked in connection with Cuba and in normalizing or improving a bilateral relationship between Mexico and Cuba, which at one point had actually kind of deteriorated or declined. And given the fact that the U.S. is kind of in a similar situation, so to speak, of working to normalize, I'd be curious what your impressions were with working with the Cubans and where you see the opportunities for the Mexican economy as Cuba goes about restructuring and updating its and modernizing its economy.
Okay. Since this is not off the record, let me separate
We can go off the record.
It's fine. I mean, thank you, though. I appreciate it. I think that the debate about Cuba, and it's a debate with which we struggled with at the time that I was there, and it's a debate that the United States, I think, very much struggles with on foreign policies. Do you engage and try to change things, or do you back off and pressure with whatever you have to achieve change? That's the central debate, and that's every diplomat's debate in some way nowadays. At that time, what we decided was the best way, I mean, let me be diplomatic. Few would challenge the notion that Cuba still has a long way to go in terms of consolidating democracy. Let's just put it that way, okay? How do you deal with that? And there's basically, again, two avenues. I and this is a personal view, I normally try, I tend to be on the side of engagement. And I think that in the case of Cuba, democracy is like humidity. Once it gets in, it's very difficult to go out. And probably the best way to do it is engaging more, opening to trade, because then that's what generates change. It wasn't easy for Mexico at that time. And the president was very much on the line, President Calderon at that time, and that doesn't mean that the question always how do you promote stronger human rights? And you see it all over the world, that type of debate. We just recently saw it in Venezuela, where the United States, Canada, Mexico, and initially 11 other countries said enough is enough at the OAS and said, we're no longer putting up with this. We need to, twist it a little bit more with whatever we have available because the regime was given a chance to change by itself, to decide, and that's always, that you have to respect that. It's not for anybody to decide who should govern Cuba or any other country, Venezuela, or the United, that's not the point. But it's to protect democratic institutions. And I think that, there was a dialogue that was initiated along with the Vatican, and that didn't seem to go anywhere, and, there have been 3 or 4 years of trying different attempts. That didn't work. So another more pressure had to be put on. My personal view, I think that the United States, the idea to further engage with Cuba will foster change more rapidly there, if that's what it's thought. And I think that once that happens, we are going to have the Galveston, Cuba, Cancun cruise line anytime soon.
I think this will be our last question. We may be able to take one more.
Okay. Ambassador, The energy sector was excluded from NAFTA, and obviously that was 23 years ago. How will you approach the energy sector in the renegotiation of NAFTA?
That's a very good question for which I cannot provide a full answer, but I tell you where we are. There are two views on that regard. The general view is that North America has a huge potential, given its energy resources, to achieve energy security, understanding energy security as having access to energy in a reliable way and at competitive prices. And we do have that opportunity with Canada, Mexico, and the United States. That's the line of thinking. So one line of thinking is, what do we need to do to harmonize regulation work, you know, understand better our relation in a way that we can achieve that, and we can better interconnect our energy markets and energy systems. That I think it's desirable, and I think it's pretty feasible. The other thing is a debate about whether, on the Mexican case, since the energy sector was excluded from the negotiations, does it need to be now introduced into the NAFTA text? That's a question that some people pose. And I've heard, quite frankly, both views. Some say, no, that's not necessary because there's an interpretation on the NAFTA text that would say it doesn't matter. Once it was reformed, the constitutional reform took place in Mexico, and all the, you know, secondary legislation, that automatically, those investments are protected by NAFTA once the reform took place. And there are other views that say, well, we should include that into the text of the... It's still, in my view, up for debate. But what we have felt so far in terms of the investment that is taking place after the reform, both in deep water, land, natural gas, all the is that they feel pretty comfortable with the security of the investments. Though they are worried about 2018 and the fact that there will be an election in Mexico and what that could bring, but that's a different debate. And so Secretary Perry, by the way, a dear Texan, now Secretary of Energy, spoke just last week with his counterpart in Mexico, and I think he's going to be visiting anytime soon in order to try to address what are the opportunities that we have in North America with the United States and with Canada in energy.
I'm sorry we're not going to be able to do it because we are running on a really tight schedule. Your Excellency, thank you so much for being with us. I want to thank you. And it is my pleasure to present you with the official World Affairs Council tie. If I could ask all of you just to remain seated for a minute.
Thank
His Excellency is going to leave with Paco and our sponsors to my office.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Now, eat some cookies, folks. Let me remind everybody that I think it's Monday night, and I apologize. I do know it is Passover, but it'll be over before sundown. We're hosting Helene Cooper. I'm still cautiously, well, actually, she has, I'm just getting a little worried that because of what's happening in Syria that maybe I'll get that dreaded phone call because she does cover the Pentagon for the New York Times. But we expect to have Helene Cooper from the New York Times here Monday night if you'd like to come. Hope to see you. Chase Untamar is also next week. Have a great weekend.